Post-Harlan Monologics. Number 00084. Recorded on May 8, 2025. Production location, Post. Harlan. Texas. Chapter 84. Hornswoggle, Part 3. Hornswoggle, Part 3. Chapter 84.
The opinions of Maverick 88 are not necessarily the opinions of Maverick 88. Sensitive content warning. Viewer discretion is advised.
Now, buckle up. You are on the runaway train of thought. Ladies and gentlemen, without any further ado, the one, the only, Maverick 88. This monologue is continued from the previous episode, Chapter 00083, Hornswoggle, Part 2. And now, the conclusion of the Hornswoggle series.
Now I talk about the lifestyles as it pertains to professional wrestlers and how they are accommodated differently on the path of their careers, depending on whether they're fighting as high card, mid card, or low card performers, right? High card is the famous ones, and they fight for more money. Their matches are higher paying gigs, while on the other end of the spectrum, the low card is the least famous people, actual no names basically, and they get paid very little in comparison. And with that little pay, they have a seriously much less lavish lifestyle, right? Roach motels shared with 3, 4, 5 other guys, eating bologna sandwiches, right? That life. However, whichever card, whichever level, whichever tier you may be performing at, the pro wrestler tragedy does not discriminate. Does not discriminate. The lifestyle, at least as it was from, say, 20 years ago through the prior, like, 30 or 40 years, right? Especially in the 80s and into the 90s. The lifestyle as it was, no discrimination. Tragedy befalls so many of these people at a young age. There's, you know, what I would call lifestyle, wrestler lifestyle related deaths. And look, the variety of them that happened. These were wrestlers. And the list is long if I went by name, right? If I just named out the names and told you the age of every single guy and then what the cause of death was, it's a long ass list. And that's with wrestlers of some notoriety. There's a lot of those low card types that just don't have a history, a biography that goes with them, right? They might have played the wrestling game for 2, 3 years, walked away from it, died 10 years later, and it seemed unrelated to wrestling. But it could have been like, you know, a head injury that happened. And look at these different kind of deaths, right? These are for guys that died under the age of 50. I'll consider that relatively young. I'll consider that a short lifespan in this day and age. These people were deprived of a good 25 years of life. By death, that I see as equating with the lifestyle of a professional wrestler, right? So you have like stage moves resulting in death. What that means is, you know, somebody threw you down a certain way. You landed on your head, you landed on your neck. There's a story of a guy who took a kick to the chest and his heart stopped and he died in the ring, right? Stage moves resulting in death. There was also the famous one, Owen Hart, right? Bret the Hitman Hart's younger brother, Canadian guy. They were doing some kind of thing where he was supposed to descend from the ceiling of an arena down to the mat. And the cable that was holding him up and supposedly it was supposed to lower him snapped or something. And he fell. He went falling down like some 30, 40, 50 feet and died. He died right there with all the fans watching. And it's crazy. But that, I would consider that a stage move, a stage event that resulted in death. And there's a whole variety of these kind of things, you know, moves that happen, stunts like that that go bad. You know, many guys under the age of 50 die that way. Suicide. And suicides of every kind. ODs. Many ODs. Intentional ODs, I should say. Gunshots. A lot of those, too. And a couple hanging. And I saw some story briefly. A guy hung himself from the turnbuckle in a wrestling ring on purpose. I don't even know how you do that, but he did that, and that's how he died. And it was a suicide, right? Hung himself right there. And I don't know who the guy was. It's a name that escapes me right now, and it's somebody who I never understood as any kind of famous, at least as far as I understand fame and wrestling to go. There was a murder, a famous story that happened in Puerto Rico with some guy back in the 70s. He was down there and he got into an argument with somebody in the locker room and he got stabbed to death right there. The lifestyle. Domestic violence, right? There was a horrible story out of the Atlanta area 20 years ago or so. Chris Benoit, right? Chris Benoit, Canadian dude. I'm pretty sure he's a Canadian dude. All jacked up on steroids, taking all kinds of amphetamines and drugs and shit like that. He had some issues, obviously. He killed his wife and his baby son, and then he killed himself, right? So it was a double murder suicide, a fratricide, killed his own baby, and crazy stuff. And, of course, there's a lot of intrigue involved with something like that. Nobody was there to see it. Nobody really knows exactly what was going on and what happened and how it played out. So, but you could see documentaries about that all over. But, yeah, domestic violence ends in murder. His wife apparently was somehow involved with wrestling, so she was murdered. That's a way she lost life. And, of course, the Chris Benoit committed suicide. Accidental overdoses, right? Just partying too much. There's a lot of that. A lot of that with professional wrestlers. Very long list of that kind of stuff. And all kinds of different drugs, too. We'll get into that with the Von Erichs, where there was accidental, where there was intentional. Crazy tragedy, right? And a lot of it fell on one particular family. An important family in the history of professional wrestling here in America. Car wrecks, you figure, hey, partying it up, all the whiskey, all the drugs, the road rage. Yeah, you're going to get a car wreck or two, or 10, or 20, or whatever it was, but then they take lives. Then you get things that happen with the body. Liver failure, of course. When you party it up, you're going to get a bad liver eventually. And it doesn't take long. It really doesn't. Heart attacks, of course. You got to think about the size of these guys. You got to think about the intensity of their life. You know, the bigger, stronger you are, the harder you're working in the gym. The intensity of your physical challenge and the competition you have with the your contemporaries around you. I mean, I remember how it was when I was in my 30s and I was on my way to a heart attack. And I'd be in there doing squats with a cigarette hanging out my mouth. And I was just pushing for it, right? And but you got guys who are 300 plus pounds. They're not just muscular and strong and working hard. They're also fat as hell. You know, they eat seven meals seven courses in one meal, basically, like five times a day. They're pigs, right? Living like pigs. So you get what pigs get. you get heart problems, you get liver problems, you get the diabetes. Diabetes is on this list too. But I mean the type 2, the type of diabetes that you earn, not the type of diabetes that just happens to you, type 1, the insulin dependent type, right? And then there's cancers of every kind, including, you know, the family jewels, things that probably related to the use and abuse of steroids, right? But yeah, they get the lung cancer, brain cancer, just every kind of cancer you can think of. But at young ages, right? You're talking between 25 and 50 years old, you've got athletes, right? World-class athletes dropping dead of cancer. Why? The shit that they're putting in their body, unless it's a family, you know, lineage situation, or it just runs in the family like that, right? But I see a lot of this as, you know, it's what we brought on ourselves, and we pay a price for it eventually. And the price is suffering, pain, and a short lifespan, right? Blood clots, right? All the injuries. You get a surgery on your knee, which happens. These guys blow out their knee. These guys, I mentioned it before, like they were college and professional football players, you know, aspiring for a long career in the NFL, and they blow out their knee and they can't compete no more. They become professional wrestlers. But when that knee gets blown out and they have to put it back together, anytime you get surgery done on your legs, you're running a chance of blood clots getting up into the main artery, and it goes up through your lungs and into your heart, right? You die of the blood clot, and that can actually, you know, create strokes and heart attacks and pulmonary embolisms. That's what my man country singer Charlie Rich died of, right? He got the artery that ran up into his lungs on a way to the heart got clogged up, and he had an embolism. I don't know exactly what happens with all that, but it's apparently not a nice way to go. But yeah, blood clots from all these surgeries, especially on their legs, part of the wrestling lifestyle. Kidney failure, just like liver failure and everything else, you know, your body is just getting abused with the assortment and veracity of junk that you're pumping into it continually, you know. You get the kid, you know, renal failure. There's instances of drowning, and I don't know if that's related to partying or if that's just, I mean, there was one story that I saw, and I didn't get all the details. Person drowned in their own bathtub, and they called it a suicide. I'm thinking, how the hell do you even kill yourself drowning in a bathtub on purpose? How do you do that? Whatever happened to the old just chuck a radio in there that's plugged in and just shock yourself, you know, zap yourself out? So I don't know. There could have been foul play involved with that, but there was a couple different, and, you know, that was an incident of where I had a little bit of detail, but the other ones were just drowning, and I don't know the story around it. It could have been misadventure. It could have been innocent. Hard to say, right? And then, of course, there's quite a list, you know, that I saw where I was pulling my information from, maybe half a dozen people that just had unknown cause of death. And that just opens up Pandora's box to all kinds of speculations right there. But anything that you'd speculate would probably fall within the parameters of this list that I just laid out. It's a lot of different and assorted stuff. But we're looking at, these are things that happen to people under the age of 50, all sharing the same lifestyle, right? So it's just a lot of tragedy, a lot of bright lights burning out quick. And that's the wrestling. But, you know, like I brought up the Von Erichs because this is a Texas thing. After all, post Arlen Monologics, a Texas related podcast. And you had a whole family that endured these kinds of tragedies. The Von Erichs, they were big here in Dallas. If you heard the previous episode or two, I mentioned about them. They created something of a wrestling empire based out of Dallas with their sportatorium. Their father was Fritz Von Erich, who was a professional wrestler back in the 50s. In the 60s, and he became the promoter that developed the whole Dallas wrestling scene. And he had five sons, one of whom is still alive, the rest of whom died young, professional wrestler lives, right? it's really an incredible story of tragedy. And in the end, even the father, after losing his sons in rapid succession like this, suicides included, right? He started to lose his stuff, and then his wife left him, and then he came up with brain cancer or lung cancer, and it did him in. Fairly young, but he got into his 60s. He lived most of a full life. But he had a tragic ending also. The last 8-10 years of his life, he was the boss of all things, and then all of a sudden, he was just alone and dying. They came, the Von Erichs, they came out of Denton County somewhere. Might have been outskirts of Denton, but they had acreage up there, you know. And back in the day, you could be right by, you know, in Denton and still have acres. I was mentioning earlier on, part one, about how I'm in a kind of countrified part of Dallas County. I work in Dallas by address, but there's still a bit of country around out here. And the way Texas used to be, you had your town, and then the ranches came right up to town. You didn't really have this suburban buffer around it, right? So, so they came from Denton. Denton is due north up Interstate 35 out of Fort Worth, right? Due north of Fort Worth. So, and it's due west of McKinney on 380, just to get your bearings. Northwest of Dallas. It's a good little ride out, but it's doable. Done some things in Denton before. And now this Von Erichs and their WCW, World Class Championship Wrestling promotion in the Dallas area, was huge. So popular. More popular than I can imagine. More popular than I can probably even really deep down believe. Because back then, it just, you know, it wasn't a gazillion people in Dallas and Fort Worth and DFW like it is now. It seemed like every third person that lived here had something to do with this Von Erichs wrestling situation, you know, to hear all these stories. Hugely popular around here. In fact, so popular is a story of, the first son that died, right? And I'm getting into that just a second, next thing. When he died, they had a funeral procession for him that went from like Louisville, which is out on the way to Denton from Dallas. It went all the way down to 35 E to Dallas, or just shy of Dallas, for the burial, something like that. I don't know the exact route, but it was down 35, Interstate 35, a freeway, you know, multi-lane freeway, and they blocked off the whole freeway. Cops were playing leapfrog, exit to exit. Blocking off entry for cars to interrupt the procession. And the procession was so long, they had to do that. The popularity of this family was crazy. And the first son to die, his name was David. And David went by the Yellow Rose. That was his wrestling little moniker. And he had it embroidered on the back of his robe. He had a yellow rose on there. David Von Erich. He was very popular. Obviously, it was his funeral I was just talking about. And he died when he went on a tour in Japan, right? Japan is big into wrestling. Mexico is big into wrestling. And United States, it's like the three pro wrestling hubs internationally. And a lot of these wrestlers would escape to Japan for a little while and get paid heavily. You know, they'd work there for a couple of months and then come back here. And they learn different skills and everything like that, get additional culture, whatever. But everybody liked to go take that trip to Japan because I think the idea was it was big money. And there was some partying to do, right? Most wrestlers, most insiders would suggest that that's kind of what David Von Erich was doing. He was partying it up out there, and it took him. But then the family, on the other hand, here, let me just read here. Von Erich died during a tour of All Japan Pro Wrestling on February 10, 1984. Before defending the United National Championship belt he had won in Texas 7 days earlier. One theory of his death, this is what I was just talking about, is that it was a painkiller overdose. Perhaps hydrocodone. One of the wrestlers mentions in an autobiography of his that another wrestler removed evidence of any drug-related involvement with this death. The family, however, the Von Erichs, claim it was caused by a ruptured intestine that came from some kind of ailment or illness or disease called acute enteritis, which I'm not familiar with. Now, even though there is this serious potential for drugs being related in that death, because they're painkillers and that he was a wrestler, it still seems a little innocuous, right? I mean, if it would be like, hey, you know, I hurt, so I take codeine or Oxycontin or something, and I still hurt, do I take another one? I still hurt, I take another one. And, you know, maybe not familiar with opiates, you got to realize that some people just really don't get affected. Like me, when I was having a heart attack, they were pumping me full of morphine the whole time, and it was doing nothing for the pain. You could give me all the morphine in the world, and it wasn't going to stop what I was going through. And they had to switch up to something else, which I don't know what it was. So if you're taking some kind of opiate painkiller and it's not doing anything for you in terms of your pain, you don't understand that maybe you just got the wrong kind of medicine for your composition, for your constitution. You just take another one and another one and another one until eventually you just took one too many, right? Even though the pain isn't going away, you're still polluting and corrupting yourself with narcotics. It could cause organ failure of various kinds. I mean, you could take so much Tylenol that it, what does it do? It destroys your kidneys like instantly, right? If you go overboard with the Tylenol even. So anyway, yeah, so this guy died. And it could have been misadventure. It could have been accident. It could have been a natural cause. And it could have been a suicide. Doubtful, but I mean, it's all on the table. But he was young, and he was gone. He was popular, and then he was suddenly gone. And it really struck the wrestling scene around Dallas in a huge way. But nobody could imagine what was to come from that, you know, because after that, another brother named Mike, not even 3 years later, he died. And he did it with the intent of suicide. He left a suicide note and went over to Louisville again. There's a lake there, Louisville Lake. They used to call it Lake Dallas, apparently. He drank a whole lot of whiskey, and he took a whole lot of Placidils, right? It was sleeping pills. We used to get them. Somebody used to steal them from a pharmaceutical company in our town. The punk rockers, they used to get their hands on Placidils, and we used to party with them when I was a freshman in high school. But this guy intentionally took too many of them and washed it down with some good liquor. He had left a suicide note, so he was trying to kill himself. He went out to the lake and he OD'd and died. So now you got that tragedy compounded in the family. This time an actual suicide, and there was no way around it because he left a note. No way to sugarcoat that tale, you know. Then a third son named Chris in 1991, so another 3-4 years later, he was found by his brother Kevin, who's the surviving son, and the mother outside of their family farm in a place called Edom. Edom is, I was talking about previous episode, their acreage out in East Texas, about an hour from where I'm sitting right now at work. And he shot himself with a 9mm in the head. Another suicide. So you got three dead sons, dead in their 20s, two of them absolutely flat-out suicide of different kinds, and one of them with the potential to having had been a suicide. Then you had the fourth one, and this is one I was familiar with. I didn't realize it. I didn't know anything about the Von Erichs, but there was a wrestler in the World Wrestling Federation, late 80s, early 90s, called the Texas Tornado. This guy was Kerry Von Erich, and he may have been overall the single most popular of them all. He was Hollywood handsome. He was built like a Greek god, a statue, a comic book. It was big, handsome, tan, wild-eyed Texan. Extremely popular with the girls. They like literally fainted when he came walking by, right? He was that kind of guy. But he had been in I think it was a motorcycle wreck in the mid-80s. And he had to get his foot amputated, right? And he kept it a secret so he can go on wrestling. So for years, he was wrestling with a prosthetic. And only the most intimate people of his life knew it. And he hid it from the public. He hid it from wrestling promotions and promoters, other wrestlers. Nobody knew. Nobody knew. But he became addicted to the painkillers involved with that entire situation. Losing a foot, operating on a prosthetic, which I have a friend of mine who's had his leg chopped off and uses prosthetics. And they have to change them and upgrade them and modify them. They're looking for better technology. It's always a discomfort for them. And so I learned a little bit about that stuff on the way. So anyway, this guy, Kerry, he was taking all these painkillers. And then he got involved with other drugs, apparently, too. And then he got arrested for something involving in drugs. First time he got probation. And then he got indicted for the second charge. He was looking at jail time because he violated his probation and then whatever the charge actually was. Then he took his own life. He shot himself in the heart with a .44, right? In 1993. So only not even two, like a year and a half after the previous brother killed himself. Now you got the third one kill himself. So three out of four absolutely killed himself, with the fourth one possibly having had killed himself too. Isn't that incredible? Could you imagine? Could you just imagine? And I got to tell you, it's not impossible for this sort of thing to happen. I had a girlfriend once up in Jersey when I was in my early 30s. She had a sister who killed herself. And then eventually her brother, who was still alive when I was with her, soon after we broke up, it had nothing to do with me, but soon after we broke up, he killed himself too. So there was two suicides in that family. And you know, suicides will run in a family too. A parent will have it, the child will do it too. You know, and it could be grandparent, the parent, the child. It could be a multi-generational thing. That's real, that exists. It's messed up, but the human psyche, man, like I say, the mind is a terrible thing, you know? And like all this tragedy that happened, a lot of people who are, you know, the superstitious type, they attribute it to this particular curse that occurred prior to the oldest guy, David, dying. And it was some situation. I don't know the details of the story. You can go look them up for yourself. But it's something on the lines of, like, the enormity of the adoration that so many fans had for the Von Erichs as an institution in Dallas. A group of them, like a fan club or something, collectively got together and they constructed this kind of large, almost like funeral type of horseshoe, but it was made of yellow roses, like the Yellow Rose of Texas, which was, like I said, it was the moniker on David Von Erich's robe, and then it would become to symbolize the family in his death, right? So he was the Yellow Rose, and they made this big thing. These people, these fans, made this big horseshoe of yellow roses, and they gave it over to the Von Erichs. And it was like this big deal, and they had it in the news and on the TV and everything like that, and everybody knew about it. And somehow, some way, the Von Erichs drove off, and I don't know, they were partying it up, celebrating, and they just had this damn big horseshoe of roses in the way, and they just like chucked it out the window or something and left it in a ditch, like in a gutter. Like in a storm drain or something like that, just sitting out there on the side of the road. And, you know, big yellow horseshoe. Somebody comes by, picks it up. They saw the news. They put two and two together. And then there was a little bit of like a stain, probably more than a little bit, but there was a stain of kind of ill repute that went with that. It was a real slap in the face to the diehard fans of the Von Erichs to see that something that they developed collectively, you know, communally, was just cast aside as nothing to these people. And then once that happened, then you had the succession of all these deaths, suicides, right? And then even the father coming unglued for the last 8 or 10 years of his life, only to end in a death alone, right? This whole yellow rose thing is kind of funny. You know, being in Texas, you always hear about the yellow rose of Texas, and I never really, you know, heard about it. Like, where does that come from? What's the story behind it? Everybody associates it with Texas, with their native patriotic pride of the Republic of Texas. The story goes back to San Jacinto, where the revolution, the Texas Revolution, was won, and Texas become a republic as a result of it. Santa Anna, the guy who, he was the dictator, El Presidente of Mexico, he was the one who organized, laid the siege on the Alamo. So we remember the Alamo, but that battle went on, you know. The Mexican army moved on from the Alamo and they went east. And they ended up in San Jacinto and they lost over there, right? They lost and they lost everything. They lost all of Texas. And all of Texas back then was bigger than it is now. It would go all the way up into Colorado, further west out into New Mexico. I think it was like a lot, if not all of Oklahoma. It was much bigger then, right? It's been pared down a bit since. But that was all lost at San Jacinto. And the Yellow Rose story goes back to that. It's the lore, right? The folklore involved with it involved a mulatto woman, right? Of mixed race, biracial, maybe triracial. She's generally regarded as, you know, an American black, but of the quote-unquote high yellow variety, right? That mix lightens the skin, tints it a little bit, and you know, I work with people who got that high yellow look to them. It's not uncommon, and it often makes for a very, very handsome result, you know, that kind of mix. Not always, but it often does. And when it does, think of like Derek Jeter. Derek Jeter is a mix. He's a biracial mix. He's kind of black, he's kind of white, and he's really like that high yellow as one example. But there's so many, and, you know, a lot of famous ones too. But this high yellow person was a woman whose name was Emily West, right? And with her beauty, which was supposed to be tremendous, she went in and distracted General Presidente Santa Anna, right? The guy had like 7,000 names and titles. It was crazy. The way those Spanish were with all that stuff. But Santa Anna supposedly got very taken with this woman, got distracted in his rolling out of his plans. And it was just enough of a distraction that enabled the whole revolution to succeed. He ended up being tricked, right? He ended up being tricked and defeated. That story was brought to life quickly in song all the way back in the 1830s, right? I don't know. I don't know if the revolution aspect of it was actually in the song. I don't think it was, but the song about this woman existed somewhere from the 1830s, and the lyrics are from a perspective of a black man who adored this high yellow woman. And I think the black guy was from Tennessee, and the lyrics involved her being the prettiest girl, prettier than any girl in Tennessee. But that's who the Yellow Rose was. It was this Emily West. So now you take that origin of the lore, and then you slap that on the back of David Von Erich and call him the Yellow Rose. What are you really calling him? You could be calling him a mulatto woman. You could call him a high yellow woman, a beautiful woman. You could regard him as a distraction to Santa Anna that caused a war. What is that relation, you know? That's where it kind of gets weird, the yellow rose as a symbol. You know, I think it evolved into the idea of Texas and triumph, the victory. And that's how we, as in Texas, hold it in our heart. I'm not native Texan, and I don't really have that kind of sentiment. I wasn't raised in that. That's a cultural thing, right? that I have not yet adopted, but obviously I'm looking into it now. I'm looking at it and seeing what it is, but it just seems funny to me. It just does not seem like a good symbol for a professional wrestler. It almost just seems like the simple, plain fact that he's from Texas, and here you go. You get a yellow rose, and that's what you become. How many of you knew the story about the yellow rose of Texas, and you're Texan, huh? But the professional wrestler lifestyle, the bedlam. Obviously, it's taken a massive physical toll on all the wrestlers. And it brings them even to, you know, the brink of death and beyond, you know, out into the afterlife. With that, you have to assume, rightly so, a spiritual toll too. Where's Jesus in the middle of all this, right? Well, when you're living that high life and you're bringing yourself to death, where does the Lord fit in? I can't see how it does, you know, I can't see how it does. My involvement as a fan, a pseudo fan, you know, peripheral fan of professional wrestling, probably mentioned throughout these couple episodes here. It was early in the mid 80s, early 90s, and then 96 and 97, which was interesting. You know, we get into these, the development of what was known as the Monday Night Wars professional wrestling, right? This is the precipice. This is the brink of the future of wrestling. The outcome would determine whether wrestling would remain a regional operation like it had always been, or whether it would be consolidated into a vast monopoly and go globalist, right? And by coincidence, the catalyst that brought things down the way they came out was a group of wrestlers that called themselves the NWO, New World Order. So here's kind of sort of how the story goes. In the days of yore, right, in the territorial days of professional wrestling, the territories established themselves as a business presence in their regions through the use of local television, right? Those promotions that had some kind of access to local TV had the ability to, you know, further their promotion and get their product out in front of people. They would get stronger within their territory as a result of that. With the onset of cable television, as it started to develop in the late 70s and really blossom like on a national level in the beginning of the 80s, it was Vince McMahon up in New York who was getting himself on cable television networks that covered a wider region. And the more networks you could get yourself involved in, you can end up being just about a national entity as far as exposure for your wrestling promotion. And this was the method by which the WWF started to encroach upon territories. They got out of the north, they expanded from the northeast, and they got into Ohio, and they started pushing into the south. And in the south, you had some well-established wrestling promotions there, but there was nobody that could compete with a guy that had the WWF and New York City money plus national exposure on cable networks, right? Cable TV networks. And then Ted Turner got involved. Now, Ted Turner, I think he's still alive, Ted Turner. He's a he's a Democrat, son of a bitch, for one thing. But he's also a billionaire. He's an Atlanta billionaire. He's the guy who established CNN, Cable News Network, and TBS, that's Turner Broadcasting System. And he had all these national cable stations under his direction and ownership. So he was able to involve the local Georgia wrestling territory onto his programming. Vince McMahon tried to convince Ted Turner to get involved with what he was doing, but he resisted, and he kept the Southern thing a Southern thing and promoted that. And now the WWF had a viable alternative, somebody to stop their encroachment. And this whole situation probably was slow boiling over the course of around 15 years, like 10 to 15 years, mid-80s to the end of the 2000s. It was around 96, 97 that it started to come to a head, right? You had a lot of people jumping ship, you know, WWF people fleeing to go to the WCW is what it was called, and vice versa, right? These guys are trying to pilfer from each other, bring their stars over, and Ted Turner had his pocketbook open, and he was paying big dollars to take talent away from New York. It became the heyday of wrestling because it was just such a competition. You know, competition brings out the best in people. For a minute there, for a year or two, it was just both promotions were really, really good. And WCW was actually outperforming for a while. But what happened was a group of guys came out of the World Wrestling Federation into WCW. They went down to Georgia, but they formed up this group of heels that, like I said before, they called the NWO, the New World Order. And originally, they were a bunch of WWF guys, and they started with the intent. They actually made the announcement that they'd come down there to wreck the WCW, right? Like, as infiltrators. But it got kind of played off as a gimmick, right? Well, not a gimmick, but an angle. I get all these, all the terminology here mixed up with all this wrestling jargon. It was an angle that was being used, and it appeared to, and it was expressed as something that kind of developed organically, right? But the way it played out, you had this crew, the NWO, and they started absorbing all the WCW wrestlers. It became bigger than the WCW, even though it was within the bounds of it and being paid by it. It was a strange thing, a strange phenomenon. It really directed the course of the WCW. It was out of the control of the people down there in Georgia that was running it. Eric Bischoff, he just couldn't, you know. He was making these contract arrangements to pilfer people out of New York, and then they'd given them artistic creativity in terms of developing their gimmick and everything like that. WCW lost control of its promotion, basically, to this NWO entity. And it's funny. Well, it's not funny, but maybe in a way it is. They called themselves New World Order. They came out of a wrestling promotion that was run by a guy who was looking to be the monopolist, the globalist. He wanted to take over on a national level and consolidate all territories under his power. And you had this group of upstarts basically infiltrate his enemy like a Trojan horse. And what they did became cancerous to what the WCW had going on. And they brought him down to ruin. It brought him down to ruin. And there is no WCW. The remaining vestiges of it were incorporated into the World Wrestling Federation. They changed their name from WWF to WWE, and now you've got a complete national consolidation of wrestling territories because they conquered the big one, and the little ones were just easy. They just kind of fell in by the wayside. Like I said, you got little local shots around here, but nothing that's competitive at all with what's going on with Vince McMahon's operation, right? But that brought up the heyday. And I sat there. You know, this is when I had I call him a stepson, but I wasn't married. I was involved with the kid's mother. And so, I babysat the kid. I looked after him. at times, and I sat with them and watched wrestling, and it was right at that point of time, so I got to experience what was going on, but not really understanding the story behind it until now. So back, looking back in retrospect, what an amazing thing it really was, right? This is the post-grunge era of culture, late 90s, and you know, the WCW just went. What happened? The end of it really was, as long as you had Ted Turner's money coming in, it was salvageable. But then there was a sell-off, a buyout that went to, what was it, AE and Time Warner or something like that. Somebody bought out a portion of Ted Turner's holdings or something like that, and they were opposed to the whole wrestling thing, whether it was making money or not. They just didn't want to be associated with it. So there was friction that was going on there, and eventually they won out their case. And WCW, while it was crumbling from the inside out because of its bad contracts and that Trojan horse, it also lost its financial backing, and it lost its cable TV access. All this shit happened all at once, and it was done, you know. Again, a hell of a story, and it was a hell of a time. That's when wrestling peaked, and it ain't been anything close to it since then, you know. It lost all of its regional feel, all its territorial feel. I've lost touch with it completely, right? I can't speak to much of the history since. I've seen flashes of things, interviews, incidental, more recent matches that are on the YouTube that just, they played after something else that I was watching. I don't know the characters. I don't know anything. I found out, this is funny, there was once a midget. They had a midget. Like, yeah, there's midget wrestling, but there was actually a midget in this WWE. They dressed him up like a leprechaun. His name was Hornswoggle, right? Funny as shit. And, well, if you know me, you know what I think about midgets. I say they could read a phone book and I would crack up. Anything that a midget does make me laugh. And I don't mean any of this in a derogatory way. These people are natural born comedians. It's a gift from God. You know, I think sometimes that I need an emotional support midget. And that's funny. But now look at this. This guy was into wrestling. What if you had emotional support midgets at the time, you know, in this heyday with the 80s and the 90s and all this drugs and all this tragedy? What if you had just a couple of strategically placed midgets involved with that wrestling scene that would bring the levity, bring that emotional support, right? The emotional support midget. Could lives have been saved? Could tragedy have been averted? We will never know.
Thank you for tuning into Post-Arlen Monologics. Further information involving this project and archived releases of Post-Arlen Monologics can be accessed over the World Wide Web at postarlen.com. Comments, critiques, and inquiries may be submitted to Maverick through email at maverick88@postarlen.com.